This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The MLB All-Star Game is Tuesday night in Washington, D.C. That means it's time for the OAG Investigative Unit to release the results of a months-long probe into the origin of a song you may hear in anticipation of Tuesday's game. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story.
I think it was the first song I ever knew all the words to.
I just remember it taking over.
And I took great pride in knowing all the words because they come very fast.
There's probably five different stations I listened to regularly, and it was probably on one of them at any given moment.
I also really realized that there was something kind of poetic about it. You know, it's a cold world. They say it gets colder. So what's wrong with
taking the back streets? The song, of course, is Smash Mouth's 1999 hit, All Star. Hey now, you're an all star. Get your game on. All-Star reached number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100, but with those timeless lyrics, hey now, you're an all-star, get your game on, go play, it was quickly number 1 in the hearts of young sports fans. I can still remember an end-of-season Little League barbecue at which All-Star just played on repeat. It's all my fellow preteens and I wanted to hear. The song got so big so fast that Smash Mouth was called on to perform at Fenway Park before the 1999 Home Run Derby. But it turns out that All-Star, the sports anthem of my generation, actually wasn't meant for sports fans.
How much was sports on your mind, though, as you were writing the lyrics?
It wasn't the inspiration for it. I think the inspiration for it was me looking at my shoe.
That's Smash Mouth songwriter slash guitarist Greg Camp, and we'll get back to his shoe. But that's not the only surprising finding from our investigation. There's also this from producer Eric Valentine.
That song almost did not exist.
Back in early 1997, otherwise known as 2BAS or Before All-Star, Smash Mouth, then a little-known band from San Jose, California, was on thin ice.
Because our band was about to break up. We'd been together for like 2.5 years and nothing had happened.
That's Smash Mouth's bass player, Paul Delisle. And when he says nothing had happened, he means the band still hadn't been signed by a major label.
We weren't getting anywhere as quick as we wanted to.
That's Greg Camp again.
And so we decided to fire our manager. And our manager said, what can I do to keep you guys? We said, we want $10,000 to go record with this producer named Eric Valentine.
Eric Valentine was an up-and-coming producer who also lived in the Bay Area.
Our manager said, okay, done. And so he gave us the money.
Paul Delisle doesn't remember the band threatening to fire its manager.
But I do remember him giving us 10 grand and just thinking he was just nuts. Just like, why don't you just burn it, you know?
So Smash Mouth got the money to book their dream producer, and soon they were ready to record at Eric Valentine's studio.
You pretty much walk through the door and you're stepping on old burritos and cables.
There isn't a maid service at the studio. What can I tell you?
That's Eric. Anyway, back to Greg.
You walk through a little maze of speakers and things, and there's Eric, the mad scientist, sitting back there. Looks like he hasn't ever been outside, you know? And just a genius, mad scientist genius.
Eric says it's not entirely true that he never went outside.
Towards the end of 96, I went on a scuba diving trip with my dad.
Anyway, to make a long story short, Smash Mouth and Eric Valentine hit it off, and they put together a song that Greg had written called Walking on the Sun, and that changed everything. So don't delay, act now,
supplies are running out. It immediately became a huge hit.
Smash Mouth was signed by Interscope Records. The band put out its first album and started touring. And here's where I want to tell you about one important dynamic within Smash Mouth.
Could you rank the, you know, original members of Smash Mouth as far as their sports fandom?
Okay, for Greg, it's almost non-existent.
Greg, remember, is the band's chief songwriter.
I don't know how to play sports very well.
And were the other guys in the group big sports fans?
Yes, all of them.
I'm a sports fanatic.
That's lead singer Steve Harwell.
So I watch it every morning, every day. I listen to it, sports talk radio.
I played ice hockey till I was 15.
So on the tour bus, it was all sports all the time, at least for everyone except Greg. If the guys weren't watching a game on TV, they were playing a sports game on Xbox. Greg says that was fine with him. But when he started reading through the band's fan mail, he could tell that Smash Mouth's biggest fans weren't mainstream sports fanatics.
These were outsiders. They wanted to spend more time in art class, and they weren't punk, they weren't rock, they weren't BMX, they weren't skater, they weren't surfers. They were kind of either all of those things or some of those things.
Greg says that a lot of those kids would write in with stories of being bullied
by other kids or their siblings or their parents or their step-parents. It was like, wow, like, we're sort of like, like this healing thing for these kids, you know? So we would respond to those letters.
Smash Mouth kept touring their first album into 1998, and the band got used to hearing a particular phrase.
All we heard was one hit wonder. They're done. That's it. Critics didn't like us.
But Greg was already writing songs for the band's second album. And when Smash Mouth returned to Northern California, they went back to record with Eric Valentine. Everything was going to plan. Here's Eric.
We had a finished record for their second album, Astro Lounge, that we thought was amazing. Like, yep, high five, home run, grand slam. This is the thing.
We turned in what we thought was the finished album.
Greg Camp again.
And I got a call from our manager and said, you know, get on a plane and get down to LA, that the Interscope wants to talk to you. And so it was like going to the principal's office.
Meetings with the Interscope execs could mean trouble. Greg still remembers one talk with Interscope co-founder Jimmy Iovine that went like this.
I remember Jimmy Iovine sitting, kind of almost laying on a couch, like on a sofa in his office, with his stereo next to him with a big volume knob on it, and him just like blasting the music. And he would only turn it down long enough to say something and then turn it all the way back up so you couldn't respond. You know, he's like, you turn it down and go, where's the chorus? And then turn it all the way back up.
But this time, after Smash Mouth turned in what they thought was their finished second album, Greg was called in for a meeting at the home of another Interscope executive.
They're just like, where's the hit? This isn't it. This isn't, we got a second single, you got a third single, maybe a fourth single, but you don't have a first single. We're not going to put this out until you give us something better than this.
And it was just like, very, very frustrating to hear, because we had really worked hard on everything up to that point.
Greg went home, hunkered down in his garage, and tried to create a hit.
You know, I think I picked up a Billboard magazine and like, what do people listen to these days? You know, it's like, I don't listen to the radio. So I was just checking it out and I'm like, all right, okay. We need something that's going to be a little funky. That's kind of why I started with the breakbeat.
And sorry, can you just describe what is a breakbeat?
Oh, it's like just a beat from an old song. So I was like, you know, like that kind of thing.
And when he started to write the lyrics, Greg found himself thinking about all those letters he'd read on tour. The ones from the kids who said they were bullied. Greg decided to write a song for them.
Sort of like a self-affirmation, don't let these people get you down, go get them.
And this is where Greg's footwear comes into the story.
The whole All-Star thing, I think I was probably wearing Converse All-Stars, which is what I always wore. And I think it just went click, click, click. You know, like All-Star, wow. It's like, what does that mean? I think it means when a bunch of exceptional players get together and have a team. Is that what that means? And so, you know, it was like, oh, this could sort of relate to a kid who just needs a pep talk.
Greg put together a demo of the song, singing the lyrics himself. He played it for the band.
They're like, oh, this can be a long couple years.
So you guys knew like this was gonna be a hit.
We had a feeling, yeah.
Singer Steve Harwell remembers the moment well.
They said, this is like a smash. This is going to be life-changing. And we knew it. And I knew it right away.
I just, you know, said at one point, I think this song will definitely do what the record company wants it to do, but it you may potentially fly your band straight into the sun with this song, because there's no turning back from this. But everybody agreed that it's too valuable to try and be too cool to put it out.
So they put together an emergency recording session, and All Star was born.
Somebody once told me the world is gonna roll me. I ain't the sharpest tool in the shed.
It shot pretty quickly up the charts.
And while Greg may have written the song for the Outsider Kids, it became a sports anthem.
I guess it got co-opted. Hey, it's fine with us, you know. Greg should be very proud for writing that song, because it's not just a song, it's like a cultural institution, you know?
In the years since Smash Mouth's only non-sports fan wrote the sports anthem of a generation, the band has performed at dozens of baseball, football, and basketball games. Mark Cuban picked them up in his private jet so they could perform at a Dallas Mavericks game. The song famously appeared in the 2001 movie Shrek. In recent years, Greg Camp has been doing his own music production and writing songs for other artists. But he, Paul, and Steve still tour with Smash Mouth. And the song All Star is still out there. Greg says he was at the park the other day, pushing his daughter on the swing, when the little boy next to them started singing the song.
And my daughter looked at me like, what the? Do you know him? I don't. It's a double-edged sword because, you know, that is the top rung. You know, it's like, that's about as good as you're going to get. You know, still to this day, if someone wants to work with me or someone wants to do a song or something like that, they're like, let's do another All-Star. I'm like, oh, get right on that, pal. You know, it's like, it's just I don't know, it's just a one-of-a-kind thing. Hey now, you're an All-Star.
Get your game on, go play. Thanks to Only a Game's Martin Kessler for his months of hard work on that story. Thanks also to Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder and CBS Boston sports writer Michael Hurley for sharing their fond memories of All-Star. Remember, only shooting stars break the mold. yeah. Every once in a while, and I'm sure this came to mind because of Martin's story about Smash Mouth and All Star, but every once in a while, a sports-related song comes along and you think, hey, that's terrific. I thought John Fogerty's Center Field was so terrific that I had to think up something to say about baseball so I could get that song on the radio before everybody else used it and made it a cliche, which, of course, it became. Who knows what I said about baseball mere hours after I'd first heard Center Field. It was 1985, only a year or so after I first started writing radio stuff, a long time ago. I just wanted to use the song. And now John Fogerty's 73, and I'm, yikes, 70 this week. And you know what? Somebody writes a song like that again, I'm likely to try to convince people here to let me invent a reason to put a little piece of it out there like I did 33 years ago. So, you gotta grow old, sure, but you don't have to grow up. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR.
When the Supreme Court heard the travel ban case this spring,
Donald Trump, President of the United States versus Hawaii,
one family's story came up in oral arguments.
This is a 10-year-old daughter in Yemen with cerebral palsy who wants to come to the United States to save her life. And she can't.
What happens to that girl and her family? On the next Embedded, on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know. The NFL's anthem policy is back in the news, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by ESPN's Howard Bryant. Howard, welcome back.
Thank you.
And by the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Welcome, Nora.
Thank you very much, Bill.
This week, the NFL Players Association filed a grievance protesting the NFL's national anthem policy. Commissioner Goodell had announced that players who didn't want to stand on the field during the playing of the anthem could remain in the locker room. The Players Union, which has also suggested negotiations with the league, has maintained that the policy seeks to, quote, thwart their constitutional rights. Malcolm Jenkins of the Eagles put it this way: everyone loses when voices are stifled. And the NFLPA is also contending that the league should not have instituted any policy without consulting with the players' union first. The NFL was hoping to turn everybody's attention back to the game on the field. Am I wrong in suggesting that the league completely underestimated the determination of the players to be heard in their opposition to racism and police brutality against minority citizens? And is anybody surprised that the NFLPA didn't accept stay in the locker room as an option? Howard?
Well, I think that the players sort of set themselves up on this, because if they had been hostile from the start, as they, I think they should have been, if they had been a union from the start, if the union had stepped forward and said, listen, even back in September when Donald Trump had called the players SOBs, instead of sort of being passive, which they had been, I think you'd have a different outcome right now. Now the players have to mount some sort of defense, and we're starting to see that. But they could have done this back in September.
Yeah, to be fair, individual players did stand up and did act and had something to say. The union, as you say, was very slow to react. But
they didn't know what to do.
They finally discovered what to do.
So what I will say is that the players were in some ways divided. But the thing that does seem to really unite these guys is when they feel disrespected. When Donald Trump made those comments, that was what really catalyzed a lot of unity among the players. It's a smaller scale, you know, no one's using the same type of language. But yet. I do think that you saw, sure, I don't think we'll be getting that from Roger Goodell, but I think you did see, you know, guys like Devin McCourty, who are involved with the Players Coalition, which is the group that's been most receptive to being a partner with the league. They said in response to the new rule, no one called us. No one talked to us. We have a history of working with these guys and no one reached out. There's absolutely a good chance that more guys will protest just because they've been told that they can't.
It's interesting to me that now, fairly close to the time when training camps are going to open, the NFL does have to worry that this story is ongoing. They do not know week to week exactly what players are going to do because there is no agreement.
Well, it's their own fault. It's their own fault because I think that they felt... Look, they won. They'd already had Kaepernick out of the league. Nobody has given Eric Reid a job, so he's out of the league. And then what did the owners do? They bow to the president, and they essentially stab the players in the back, and here we go.
Nora, take us away from this potentially ongoing hideous situation, at least as far as the NFL is concerned. What's on your mind this week?
I am just consumed by World Cup coverage. I love it. 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 But
I think she likes
it. There's a lot of love in there. There's a lot of love in the room.
And one of the things that I was loving so much was watching England, team that, you know, was exceeding expectations. And one of the best things about it was they had this catchy song. It's called Three Lions, and it's been sort of the unofficial theme song of England's soccer team, football, if you prefer, since it was commissioned in 1996 when England was about to hold the European Cup. And it has this wonderful sort of Beatles light-esque choral refrain about, it's coming home, it's coming home. It's coming home. Since England was going to host the European Cup, it was international soccer returning to the place that considers itself the birthplace of the game. England thought it was going to host this World Cup, but Russia, which has come under scrutiny for, you know, a ton of bribery.
No.
I know. Shocked, I tell you. You know, Russia, which was considered to have one of the weaker bids, ends up winning out over England, which was part of the investigation into corruption and bribery in FIFA. Voters accepting Picassos in exchange for their votes.
Not to mention envelopes stuffed with
envelopes
cash.
Stuffed
sure,
with money.
Yes.
I always go for the direct.
Exactly.
Forget the Picasso. Who knows what it's actually worth? Give me the envelope full of money.
I like the dramatic. I like the idea of, you know, how do you even, who transports the paintings? Mm.
Nora, if the sports writing thing doesn't work out, Nashville could be your next option. Very nicely done. But my main point vis-a-vis your song is I hope the song goes on because it's only 4 years until the next World Cup, you know, and it is never too early to start building momentum.
Absolutely. And I think it's fun. And I think you need that. And I think that one of the things that I enjoy most about the World Cup, not being an everyday soccer watcher, I'm not the guy watching the Premier League. I'm not that guy. But I do watch the World Cup because of the spectacle of it. It's a great, great tournament. And I think it's actually a lot of fun, the fact that England was under the radar. And normally, they walk in there chest puffing and then they lose and they leave head down. But this was very different. Is it possible to have an English Cinderella story? This was one of them. It was a good story.
I just want them to keep playing the song, even in the off years.
That's what I'm saying.
It's going to become your Sweet Caroline.
You just
hold on to it.
Howard, we're going to close out with an NBA story, and you've brought it to us.
Yes, well, the Golden State Warriors won the NBA title again, and they backed it up by signing DeMarcus Cousins, one of the best players in the NBA. And now everyone is losing their minds because the Warriors are going to have next season, they'll have a starting lineup at some point when he comes back from injury of 5 players who made the All-Star team this past season. It's Yankee-esque, right? And so people are thinking, break up the Warriors. But the commissioner, Adam Silver, sort of during his State of the Union address with the league, talked about how it was important to have the Warriors be dominant and that they should continue their dominance. And it's been fascinating that this team, the Golden State Warriors, they've been terrible for so many years. And now we're talking about them like they're Microsoft or like they're Apple or something. And so there's a movement to break up the Warriors. And I'm wondering what's happened to us and what happened to our sort of institutional memory when you look at the Los Angeles Lakers from 1980 to 2010. The Lakers won 16 Western Conference championships, 16 out of 30, and they won 10 championships. The Celtics won, they went to the finals 12 out of 13 years, and they won 8 straight titles in the 1960s. So it's interesting to me that now we have this sort of the NBA is doomed argument simply because Kevin Durant went to the Warriors and because the Warriors are having a nice little run right now. So part of me asks the question, what happened to our collective attitude? Do we simply not know the NBA, or have we just reached a point where are we upset that players are making these decisions to go and use their power and change the balance? Because when teams trade players, very few times do people say anything. They may get upset for a day or two, but they don't say the entire league is in trouble.
That is one of the things that continues to boggle my mind, is that people do tend to take the side of billionaire owners over, you know, it's management over labor. And you see time and time again, that does tend to be the perspective a lot of fans take. I've never really understood why, except that it has to do with your root for the laundry kind of thing. So I think there's some merit to that. I don't personally get it.
It's not a new argument, as you have pointed out. And in fact, we used to hear it all the time, and sometimes we still do, about the UConn women's basketball
team.
They're too good. They go 38-0, 39-0. They never lose. I'd like to point out that they have not been the champions the last two years.
That's right.
And that Gino Auriemma, the coach of that team, had, I thought, the perfect response. His response was, why don't the other teams get better?
Well, and that's the other point about this. I think that when I look at this, it's happening in a time frame where we are encouraging and organizations are flaunting the idea of tanking, of losing on purpose. And people, when they deal with this, they say, well, the organization's got a strategy. And they say, oh, this is part of the plan. This is how you get better. I think the Warriors have a pretty good plan, too, which is to get better every every single month, and beat you right here and beat you right now.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Howard Bryant of ESPN and NPR and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiati. Thanks to both of you.
You got it.
Thank you.
Ah, summertime, long days of leisure, laughter, eating, sitting by the pool, waiting for somebody, a lifeguard, a parent, to give you the okay to get back in the water. You remember those days, don't you? Here's Only a Game's Karen Given.
When my mom was a kid growing up in Southern California, her grandparents owned a pool. My mom would spend her entire summer in that pool, except for 1 hour every day after lunch when her grandparents would make her play canasta. Nancy Wiener Marcus is a little older than my mom. She's 75, and she grew up in Dallas, Texas.
It was a known rule. I loved to eat a cheeseburger and a chocolate malt and then fries. And I knew that, God forbid, I would have to get back into the water for, I guess, even to save someone. There'd just be no way because I'd drown for sure.
Here's Katie Martin. She's 22.
I grew up in Toronto, Ontario. I'm Canadian.
Katie wouldn't go swimming after eating either.
Absolutely not, because, first of all, I don't know if you've read A Series of Unfortunate Events.
I haven't, but Katie tells me that the books follow three orphans who are sent to live with a series of relatives, and everywhere they go, terrible, or at least unfortunate, things happen.
They go and live with their aunt, I think, who lives by a lake, and this lake is infested with flesh-eating leeches.
Ew.
Yes, it's very gross. They can smell food from miles away. And if you go in the water and you smell like food, they will, like, eat the flesh right off your bones.
Back in Dallas, Nancy had a more reasonable-sounding explanation for the rule.
I'll get a cramp because I will not have digested my food, and then I'll drown. And so I mean, was it 100%? No one took the chance to find out.
Like, after I stopped believing in the flesh-eating leeches, because, you know, at some point, I think I just kept assuming that it was, like, a dramatization of a real thing.
Yeah.
Honestly, if you told me that was true right now, I would be willing to believe it.
Now, if I were to assure you that doctors say that there is nothing wrong with going swimming after eating, would that change your mind?
Yes, but knowing me, since I'm kind of known as a Google queen, I would have to Google it to see if it was, in fact, a myth.
I can do better than Google. Let's call up a pediatrician and public health expert.
Please feel free to stay on the line or call back when our call volume may be lighter.
Okay, so while we're waiting for the doctor, I think it's worth asking the question, where did this death by cramp idea come from anyway? A Snopes.com article cites the 1908 British Boy Scout handbook. The warning goes like this.
If you bathe within an hour and a half after taking a meal, that is, before your food is digested, you are very likely to get cramp. Cramp doubles you up in extreme pain so that you cannot move your arms or legs, and down you go. You may drown, and it will be your own fault.
I especially love that last bit. You may drown, and it will be your own fault. But
isn't Snopes.com kind of like a fact-checking
type of?
They have their facts wrong. that does not appear in the 1908 British Boy Scout handbook, because I'm holding it, and I'm looking at page 88, and it's not on there.
This is Ben Jordan. He's a history professor at Christian Brothers University in Memphis and an expert on the Boy Scouts and other early youth organizations. He says Snopes isn't too far off. A similar but less accusatory warning appears on page 223 in the health section of the 1908 handbook.
And it comes right before the don't smoke and don't drink alcohol warnings.
The warning carried over to the first American Boy Scout handbook in 1911. The man who wrote that chapter wasn't with the Boy Scouts. He was affiliated with YMCA. Like the Boy Scouts and other youth organizations of the time, the YMCA taught boys to hike, camp, and swim the right way, with the right precautions.
Otherwise, it was dangerous or would lead to immorality or excess or a number of other vices.
This idea didn't just apply to hiking and camping and swimming. It also dovetailed nicely into another movement going on at the time.
In the early 20th century, a lot of medical folks and health spas and youth organizations, psychologists and educators were very concerned about digestion.
You really must chew, Mr. Lightbody.
This is from the 1994 movie The Road to Wellville, a dark comedy allegedly set at the Battle Creek Sanatorium run by Dr. John Harvey Kellogg. Yeah, that Kellogg.
Chew, 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 but only if you chew.
Kellogg and his contemporaries saw digestion as the most important bodily function. The consequences of ignoring the rules of good digestion were considered much more dire than a simple tummy ache.
If your body isn't digesting food right, then your spirit will deteriorate.
So even though there was no evidence that swimming after eating could kill you, the warning stayed in. And that most dire warning, the one with the line that I love,
you may drown, and it will be your own fault.
That appeared in a British Boy Scout manual reprinted in 1954. In the American version of the handbook, the warning became less serious over time, finally disappearing in 1967. But in 1919, 48 years before the American Boy Scouts finally dropped their death by cramp warning, the manual for YMCA camp leaders was already hedging its bets. So if the YMCA boys program had taken off instead of Boy Scouts, we would have been divested of this wives' tale much sooner.
Yes, you could certainly say that. But then they say, but still wait that hour or two. So I guess because it happens occasionally.
But does it? Does it happen even occasionally? Time to see if the pediatrician still has us on hold.
Hi, it's Lester Hartman.
Dr. Lester Hartman has been in practice for 32 years at Westwood Mansfield Pediatrics outside of Boston. And in that time, he's logged a few patient visits.
Probably in my lifetime, somewhere between 40 and 50,000.
So in all that time, has any kid ever shown up to your office with ill effects from having gone swimming after eating?
No. No, not one.
Dr. Hartman says there have been multiple studies, and they've all come to the same conclusion. You are no more likely to drown after eating a big meal than you are on an empty stomach.
Now, you may get nauseated, but so would you if you exercise very heavily.
In fact, Dr. Hartman says, the only correlation between consumption and drowning is the consumption of alcohol.
Over 25% of the time, people died after drinking.
The Red Cross first published a study debunking the death by cramp myth in 1968, but the idea persisted. So they put out another major paper in 2011. Still, Dr. Hartman says, some parents don't want to believe that the story their mothers told them simply isn't true.
I think they're suspicious. Some people want to cling to myths.
I know what Dr. Hartman's talking about, because when I told 75-year-old Nancy Weiner Marcus that she absolutely would not drown if she went into the pool after eating her lunch, she was polite, but I could tell she didn't believe me.
Trust me, when we hang up, I will go Google it. I can promise you.
Go ahead, Nancy. I already know what you're going to find.
That's Only a Game's Karen Given. In the late 60s, Muhammad Ali and Rocky Marciano developed a friendship on a Miami movie set, and they talked about racial strife.
Rocky started talking about, what if we did a bus tour and we went around to the inner city neighborhoods across America? And then Ali got very animated, and he said, we could shake up the world, me and you.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and remember to follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
This is Peter Sagal. When we began Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we dreamed that our rude jokes would be, in the end, the appropriate way to talk about the news. And look, it happened. Listen to Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, is there any such thing as too much golf? Perhaps, but not in Scotland, right? But now it's time for my conversation about this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
As the 2018 World Cup winds down, what have been your favorite tournament memories?
Well, my predominant tournament memory is my incredible ability to jinx teams I'm actually cheering for. It started with Iceland. It moved on to Nigeria and then Senegal and then Belgium.
Oh.
So I am definitely cancer guy when it comes to people's World Cup chances.
I was going to say, that first one was an easy one. I mean, they were not anybody's
pick. Well, they were charming.
They're charming, but they weren't going to win. Okay.
Right.
Roger Federer is out of Wimbledon, but earlier in the week he warned that viewership of the World Cup final might suffer because it coincides with the men's tennis final. Bold volley by
yeah,
Mr. Federer.
I suspect that Mr. Federer is overrating the men's final, especially now that he's not in it. There's a certain amount of star power missing here.
Mexico beat Germany at the World Cup. That surprised a lot of fans. Then they fell to Brazil, led by Neymar. One team in Mexico has taken advantage of Neymar's celebrity for commercial purposes, or at least for entertainment purposes. Were you entertained by the Neymar challenge at halftime when Zolos played a friendly against Herediano of Costa Rica?
The Neymar challenge is who can fake an injury the best.
Yes.
And so you had a bunch of people rolling around in the field. Outside of the day where they had all those people with guitars in Royal Stadium doing the opening to Smoke on the Water, this is one of the great things I've ever seen in a stadium.
Yeah, they not only had to fall down on the ground, they had to roll.
They had to roll and be
and
agonized.
They measured how far each one could roll, and I think that's who won the Neymar challenge. Great stuff. On Wednesday, the Arizona Diamondbacks brought in utility infielder Daniel Descalso to pitch in their lopsided loss against the Rockies. Happens from time to time. And as you might expect, the utility infielder gave up a home run. But to whom?
The other team's pitcher, and the ball has not come down yet. Herman Marquez hit one to the moon, and this ended the Descalso experiment for the moment, I would
yeah,
expect.
Yeah, but by golly, he made Herman's day.
He did.
No question.
It's a shame Herman can't get the ball back because no one knows where it is right now.
A group of former University of Louisville basketball players is suing the NCAA for vacating the team's 2013 championship based on what's been called the escort scandal. Do they have a strong case?
They have a decent case, actually, and it's being fought not only to get the championship banner back, but also to get Luke Hancock's MVP back. he wasn't involved in the alleged scandal or actual scandal or whatever the heck was going on down there. But at the press conference, the attorney for the players referred to the NCAA as a morally bankrupt organization, and it's very hard to argue with that.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said this week that he is in favor of allowing players to move into the NBA directly from high school rather than having to play in college or elsewhere for a year. But the commissioner says the change won't come immediately. Why not? Who else has to agree that one and done is an indefensible rule?
Nobody. He can declare this a rule now. And he can tell the NCAA, the morally bankrupt organization we referred to earlier, to pound sand. You know, I don't understand what the delay is. I mean, it's not like they haven't done this before. This used to be
right. The
status quo.
Exactly. And why not change it now rather than wait for a court to say change it?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
the one-and-done rule never made any sense.
Former NBA star Charles Barkley was given a shot to win the American Century Golf Tournament this weekend. Charlie, what kind of odds are we talking about here?
A mere 6,000 to 1, Bill. It's the longest odds in the field.
Put me down for a dollar. What the heck?
Yeah, I mean, have you ever seen Charles play golf?
No.
Charles looks very much like a man digging a post hole.
Oh,
it's really kind of ugly.
Michael Bidwill, the president of the NFL's Arizona Cardinals, said this week that pro football players should restrict their comments on social issues to days when they aren't playing football. So this is what? Free speech, sometimes, not always?
Well, free speech for him and not for them. I mean, he's out there promoting the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court while he's telling his players to shut up and play on Sundays.
Yeah, but he didn't do that promotion on a game day.
No, exactly right.
You should point that out.
That's right. He did not. But you don't know.
Because they're out of season.
Well, I know, but the nomination's going to be up in September, so who knows?
Finally, Charlie, hats off, but helmets on to Travis Pastrana. His hero is Evel Knievel, who jumped a motorcycle over the fountains at Caesar's Palace back in 1967, and Pastrana paid tribute to Knievel last Sunday.
Yes, by jumping the fountains at Caesar's Palace, which was the famous trick that almost got Evel Knievel killed.
Mm-hmm.
But he managed to do it without a hitch and keep the memory of Evel Knievel alive. I just hope he doesn't get wild dreams about canyons, because that doesn't work.
In fact, he jumped those fountains 3 times.
That's right.
It makes me wonder why he stopped at 3. Do you suppose he ran out of gas?
Well, once you've done it the 3rd time, it gets boring.
I guess.
I mean, you got to go find the Trevi Fountain or Victoria Falls or something.
All the spectators went home.
That's right. And Bob's seen this before. We've seen a guy jump the fountain 3 times. Let's go back to the Mirage and watch the volcano blow off again.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
It's 1967. Smokey Robinson and the Miracles, the Supremes, and the Beatles were on the radio, but tune in at the right time, and you could also hear the Super Fight.
That was the brainchild of this pudgy disc jockey and promoter named Murray Warner.
That's author Mike Stanton.
He got 250 boxing writers, and he gave them a questionnaire and had them answer all these characteristics to rate the greatest fighters.
From the data he collected, Warner developed a list of 16 of history's greatest heavyweights. And then he wrote a radio script of simulated fights, including sound effects, that had the fighters battling through an elimination tournament to determine the greatest of them all. To ensure that the judging would be completely indisputable, Warner fed the opinions of the writers into a computer, the formidable NCR 315.
The public loved it. It had a huge audience. It was a huge success. And even though computer algorithms try to take the emotion out of these barroom debates, you had angry letters from fans about their fighter losing. You had accusations that the computer took a dive.
Yeah, because boxing. But there were no angry letters from the fans of the winner, Rocky Marciano, who had retired as the undefeated heavyweight champion in 1956.
Rocky was amused, and he actually was given a $10,000 jeweled belt as this mythic champion of all time.
A more recent heavyweight champ was not similarly amused.
Muhammad Ali was knocked out in the 2nd round of this tournament by Jim Jeffries. And this was a rough time for Ali. He was suspended from boxing after refusing the draft to fight in Vietnam. Couldn't fight, needed money. And he sued Murray Warner for $1 million, saying, "You've impugned my reputation by saying I would lose to Jim Jeffries when I am the greatest." So Warner very shrewdly settled the suit for $1. and Muhammad Ali's agreement to do a filmed computer fight against Rocky Marciano.
A cinematic pseudo-fight, actually, and Warner was certain a gullible public would eat it up.
So they go into this studio, and they filmed 71-minute rounds and a variety of scenarios. And sometimes the two men would get carried away and forget that this was only make-believe. They filmed for 3 days in a Miami studio with blacked-out windows and tight security. And in fact, they filmed the final scenes just days after a federal court judge had ordered Ali to go to prison. They seemed like polar opposites, the white conformist from the 1950s and the black rebel from the 1960s. But there was this mutual respect. When Rocky was coming up, you know, young Cassius Clay would listen to that transistor radio carrying the fight from faraway Madison Square Garden, and he'd hear heavyweight champion of the world, and he wanted to be Rocky.
It was easy to understand why the deal appealed to Ali. He needed the money, but Rocky Marciano probably didn't.
He hoarded cash, he didn't take checks, and he was very eccentric. He would hide cash in toilet bowls and curtain rods.
Rocky was also said to have stashed suitcases full of cash in a friend's bomb shelter, but apparently he relished the challenge to get back in shape, and he had finished his career 49-0. Why wouldn't he have figured that despite Ali's ridiculous advantage in weight, height, and reach, he could extend his undefeated record? So pride was a factor. That became apparent when director Warner wanted the fighters to stage knockdowns.
Rocky had only been knocked down twice in his career, and he was embarrassed both times, even though that's part of the game. And Ali had never been knocked down. And finally, Rocky agreed to go down, and Ali threw a punch, hit him. Rocky went down. Ali yelled, "Drop the wop." And Rocky rolled over, took his mouthpiece out, and started laughing hysterically.
Sounds as if it might have been kind of fun. Sometimes, not always. Both guys were, after all, boxers, and at 46, Rocky could still hit. At one point, he nailed Ali in the bread box.
And Ali just kind of exhaled and he goes, oof, and he sat down on his stool. And he refused to get up and resume filming until Murray Warner sent an aide to the bank to get $2,000 in cash and bring it back and give it to Ali to continue.
As the two men labored to bring Murray Warner's goofy script to the screen, a strange thing began to happen. Strange and potentially wonderful.
The two of them got to talking one day during a break in the filming. And they sat together by the side of the ring, and they had a bag of grapefruits. And Ali was peeling the grapefruits and ripping off sections and passing some over to Rocky. They started to talk about the racial strife in America. And Rocky started talking about, what if we did a bus tour and we went around to the inner city neighborhoods across America? And Ali got enthusiastic and said, imagine Muhammad Ali and Rocky Marciano going into the worst areas, Watts, all these other places, and say, hey guys, come on, we could get along. And then Ali got very animated, and he said, we could shake up the world, me and you. Would you do it? Would you do it? Would you do it? And Rocky said, yeah, I'll do it.
Ali and Marciano didn't know which of them would be declared the winner by Murray Warner's NCR 315. They only knew that they'd found they had something in common that was more important than this project. The conviction that together they could make a difference in a realm much larger and more significant than the boxing ring or the box office. And they'd begun to care about each other.
Ali's wife at the time pulled Rocky aside and she said, worried for Muhammad's long-term health, prophetically so, do you think I can get him to walk away from the ring before it's too late?
Rocky, who'd apparently stepped away from boxing in pretty good shape, didn't think Ali would be able to do the same. He said the champ's ego was so big that somebody would have to knock him out of the ring to make him stop fighting. As it turned out, prosecutors determined to end Ali's career were foiled in that attempt by the Supreme Court. The champ would return to the ring in the fall of 1970, and the plan to tour the country with Rocky Marciano promoting racial harmony? No, because just a few weeks after the final filming session of the superfight,
Rocky Marciano was on the eve of his 46th birthday, and he was supposed to fly home from an appearance in Chicago. And then he got a last-minute offer to fly to Des Moines, Iowa, to the opening of a steakhouse owned by a nephew of a mob friend of his from Chicago named Frankie Farrell. So, unfortunately, on this day, they had a very inexperienced pilot who wasn't trained to fly with instruments when visibility was poor, and they were flying into a massive storm system over the Midwest. and they crashed in a cornfield, and he died.
Sports columnist Jim Murray had the perfect epitaph. "Start the count," Murray wrote. "He'll get up." He went on to say, "A lot of us today are wishing there were an honest referee in a cornfield in Iowa." But what about the result of Rocky's last fight? Surely the bloodless computer wouldn't take into account sudden death by accident, and just as surely Murray Warner had on his hands a movie bearing emotional baggage he couldn't have imagined while he was calling for a left hook, a right cross, and so on.
Marciano about 5'11", Cassius Clay about 6'3", perhaps a little bit more.
A prize fight in which one of the combatants enjoys a 20-pound advantage over the other is rare, and that's not the most peculiar aspect of this particular fight. Does it feel authentic to you?
No, it doesn't. It's kind of like watching professional wrestling. You know it's not real. They know it's not real. Nobody's pretending it is real. Ali towers over Rocky, and yet Rocky's belly is flat and hard, and Ali's a little pudgy and out of shape. And it's just very surreal.
There was a black curtain around the ring. There were no spectators, just the two ex-champs dancing to Murray Warner's script.
It's like they've been abducted by aliens, and they're fighting in some, you know, spaceship.
Good flurry by Cassius Clay. Good recuperation by Muhammad Ali, and now he's leading.
When the movie was finally released in January of 1970, 600-plus theaters around the country carried it. People bought tickets and went in, and they had bonded couriers deliver the reels of the film 30 minutes before the 10 p.m. start. And lo and behold, Rocky knocks him out in the 13th round.
7,000 people watched the film at Boston Garden, close by Rocky's Brockton, Massachusetts birthplace.
His father, Perino, smiled and had tears in his eyes. The first time he'd smiled since Rocky's death, they said. And he said, well, Rocky finally won his 50th fight.
Not many hustles end that poetically. And in fact, Murray Warner's didn't either.
In the European version, Muhammad Ali won.
Maybe that was in Ali's contract. In any case, Ali went on to box for another decade, creating in the process the unforgettably brutal three bouts with Joe Frazier. By the time he died just over 2 years ago, Muhammad Ali was known less as a boxer than as a global ambassador for peace and brotherhood. And Murray Warner, as one more in a long line of promoters certain that the gullibility of the public is considerably deeper than a well and wider than a barn door, he did just fine. His movie was a hit. Mike Stanton's new book is Unbeaten, Rocky Marciano's Fight for Perfection in a Crooked World. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Mike Stanton, who remembers the time Rocky Marciano brought a paper bag he'd been carrying with him to a Manhattan restaurant.
And he left it in the coat room, and when they're in the cab afterwards, Rocky asked for it and got very upset because it had $50,000 in cash. And they went back and retrieved it.
$50,000 in a paper bag. And FIFA wasn't involved. Unbelievable. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.